took my love, took it down.
Nadia Spiegelman, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Your memoir, I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This, is a memoir mostly of yourself, your mother, and your grandmother, but sort of a long line of women in your family, starting from your great-grandmother, Melanie, and then Mina, and then José, and Françoise.
You remember all the names. I'm very impressed.
And lastly, with you, Nadia. You start the book out with your experience as a teenager, sort of trying to find your own identity, which is made even more difficult than normal adolescence because of the very strong figure of your mother sort of dominating your life and dominating your reality at that time. Tell me what that was like.
I think that there's, in childhood, there's this subject-object breakdown between where you end and your mother begins, where your mother ends and the world begins, and adolescence is a period of differentiation where you try and figure out your own boundaries and limits. And my mother, who I admired and continue to admire in this outsized way, is very powerful in terms of her shaping of reality. It's part of how she accomplishes as much as she does. It's by deciding that even if there are no parking places, she's going to make one appear. Even if the couch is too wide to fit through the door, she's just going to say, couch, go in, and time space is going to bend and the couch is going to go in. But that forward-facing power is also rear-facing in the sense that she had a very clear idea of what had happened. Even fights that we'd had a week before, she would remember very differently than I did. And for me, that sense of my reality being so fused to hers was difficult. I kept a diary noting our fights in which I'd write down an R and circle it to remind myself that these things were real, at least they were real to me. And part of writing my book was about understanding that, yes, those things were real to me, but my mother's things were real to her. Everybody has different ways of remembering the same experiences, and they are all equally valid.
They are equally valid. However, when somebody denies your version of your shared reality, it effectively silences you.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me that that was the beginning, and that that had happened leapfrogging through the generations of your family, and that this was your way to sort of stop that chain and stake your claim as, this is my version, my story, me, but also acknowledging that.
It was a way of trying to find my voice and my own narrative, simultaneously by becoming the narrator of my mother and my grandmother's stories and of my own story, but also acknowledging that my voice, my own narrative, was only possible in the context of who they were and what they had lived through and how they saw the world. And at once, like everybody, I think, formed both in reaction against and in an imitation of who they had been.
Yeah. Because truth and honesty,
mm-hmm.
and it's an incredibly honest book. Truth and honesty are not twinned.
Yes, absolutely.
Especially yeah. with family.
Yeah. I mean, our lives aren't they aren't composed of perfect data sets. They're composed of selective and malleable memories out of which we create narrative. And I think everybody has had the experience of looking over some email or diary entry or primary document from their own past of, say, a relationship before the breakup, and realizing that how they'd actually felt at that moment wasn't how they remembered feeling at all. And that ability to selectively create narratives that allow us to lead up to the present moment, to reshape the past so that it makes sense as to where we've gotten now, I think that's a real power. And I think it's a real power that my mother and my grandmother both exercise very strongly. And this was my way of trying to create that for myself as well.
RadioGorgeous.com.
One of the lines in my book is, there was this deep sense of damage that had no name and no explanation. And in understanding what my mother's relationship with her parents had been, which was something I don't think I've mentioned yet, I think that she kept very much from me when I was growing up. I think there are some daughters who have very close relationships with their mothers. We were very close, but she never wanted to be my friend. She was a very French mother in the sense that she would say, I'll tell you when you're older, I'll tell you when you're older, I'll tell you when you're older, whenever I asked about her past. And it wasn't until I began writing this book at the age of 21 is when I first started working on it, that she thought very carefully about it and decided that I was asking with such urgency and need to know these things that she would grant me the openness to tell them to me. And then so in being able to see, well, first of all, just in being able to understand that my mother had once been vulnerable, led me to, I think, a lot of the book sort of axed around these questions of forgiveness, but what I ultimately came to was a profound understanding that precludes the need for forgiveness. And an understanding that she had once been vulnerable, that she had had these difficult experiences in her own life, it allowed me to be so much more comprehending of why she had acted in certain ways when I was becoming a woman.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because there's also a history. And I have to say that so much of the focus of this story and the themes of this story. I was very close with my mother. I was extremely close with my grandmother in a way that my mother was not. I was close to my mother. It came out of my troubles in adolescence, our closeness. We started speaking. She started listening. In a parallel way, I think your mother started listening to your point of view and allowed your point of view to enter her reality.
Yes, in ways that impacted how she saw herself. When I began writing this book now 7 or 8 years ago, my mother has always been an editor. She's never wanted the limelight. She's never wanted credit for her own work. She's been happy working in the shadows. But when I was coming to her with all of these questions about what it meant to become a woman, she realized, seeing herself through my eyes, that she needed, that she owed it to her daughter, this is how she said it, to take up the space in the world that she deserved. And at that moment also began sort of acting more, taking steps in her career to have more of a first-person voice behind what she had done and acknowledging the work that she had done. And that made me so proud to see.
That is a very important moment. But to see a woman valuing herself and stepping into her identity in that way.
Yeah.
And at an age where you could recognize that as well.
Yeah.
And see the consciousness of it, of that step. Because so much of that history that the women in your family, and as we all do, the trauma felt as a child or an adolescent is then revisited on the next generation in anger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we all seem to, you know, so this sort of thumb of tyranny coming through the generations, you know, it's awful. I did wonder, before I get on to other things, as I've mentioned that, if you think about having children yourself and what the consciousness of that.
Yeah, I've always assumed that I would have children. Mm-hmm. I've always somehow assumed that I would have a daughter. I admit that now, suddenly at 29, and being in a relationship with a woman, it suddenly seems much more fraught and complicated than the inevitable certainty I had assumed it would be when I was younger. But I still plan on doing that. And it was one of the things that I wanted. There's the myth in many cultures of the idea of the impacted family secret, of the family secret that is doomed to repeat itself until it comes to light, and that somehow by speaking about it or unearthing it, we can stop its continuation. I think that there's some truth to that. I also think that there's certain, we repeat certain inevitable patterns. I have absolutely no doubt that I will, if I have a daughter, do things that she resents. But
well, that is your job.
Yes, as my mother has said, like she said, but if you weren't angry at me, if you hadn't rebelled, I would have failed in my job as a mother. So
exactly. Well, you would have failed in your job as a daughter.
Yes,
to push her into owning her own.
Yes.
So therefore, that. Well, I guess we can look at it in, and you have to look at it this way, that both the negative and the positive, that certain aspects of that line of women, there are strong women, there are incredibly creative women in your family as well.
Yeah.
Just from what was at their disposal.
One of the things I found so interesting was that all four generations that I write about was so different from everybody else around them. They were not following the rules for femininity or womanhood that were given to them. And yet, unbeknownst to each other, they were, unbeknownst to themselves, they were very similar to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So tell us the story, starting with Mélanie.
Sure.
And then, you know, of these incredible women in your life.
Well, Mélanie is the vanishing point. Mélanie is my great-great-grandmother who nobody could tell me much about. My mother, everybody described her as a piece of luggage that you brought from place to place, as somebody who never spoke, as somebody who was always in the same armchair. And it was both interesting and frustrating to me to reach this vanishing point of what I would never be able to know. Her daughter, Mina, lived a very exciting life. She went skiing in the 1930s. She traveled the world. She was also the mistress of a married man and had a child who was my grandmother out of wedlock, which at the time was a huge source of shame both for her and a sense of inherited shame for my grandmother. My grandmother, José, grew up being shunted from boarding school to boarding school, from hiding place to hiding place. The unwanted natural child was how she saw herself. It was also, she was also growing up during World War II, and so there was a fair amount of her being moved around that had to do with the historical context of that. And the one thing she says that she wanted for herself was the stability of a family. So even though she was incredibly beautiful, and so in part of that had meant that she was one of France's first airline hostesses and was making this ridiculous salary in American dollars.
The very first.
She was making a huge salary in American dollars. She was flying the world over. She was greeted everywhere she landed by bouquets of flowers and stories about the airline hostesses in the newspaper and seeing the world. But she fell in love with my grandfather, who was at that time a medical student, but who went on to become one of France's first plastic surgeons. They married, and she lived this very high society life where they were frequenting actresses and models and having elaborate dinner parties where there were oyster eating contests. And she was always very renegade in the sense that she'd have these fancy dinner parties, but she'd put trick wine glasses that would spill wine down the guests' shirts, or forks that bent in half when you tried to eat with them, which was very amusing to her guests. But she had three daughters, and being a mother was never what she had wanted to do, in the sense that it wasn't where she was focusing most of her energies. And she had a very querulous relationship with my grandfather, and they divorced at a time when that was not at all common for a mother of three children to divorce, especially a woman who didn't have a source of income of her own. But my grandfather said something to her along the lines of, "Without me, you would be nothing," and she could not stand by that. So she walked out and went to go live on a houseboat on the Seine and ended up making a career of renovating houseboats into luxury homes and reselling them, that ended up earning her as much money as my grandfather had earned as a plastic surgeon, which I am very proud of her for. My mother was the middle child and always her father's favorite, and more or less the son that they had wanted to have. Her hair was cut short, she was dressed in boys' clothing, and she was supposed to become a doctor just like her father, which she took unquestioningly until she reached adolescence, at which point she realized that she did not want to do that simply because she'd never been asked if she wanted to, and rebelled, went to architecture school, ended up leaving architecture school and moving to New York simply to get away from everything that she had known. New York just seemed as far, it was the farthest away place that she could imagine. She didn't know English. She knew very little about America. For her, it was neon signs that said USA cool jeans on the Champs-Élysées. And she arrived in New York City in 1974 with about $20 in her pocket and a reservation at the YMCA, which was a men's basically homeless shelter, and from there went on to have a really interesting career in the underground art scene in Manhattan, being in George Foreman's avant-garde plays, and eventually met my father, fell in love with comics as part of falling in love with him, and ended up changing the landscape by bringing a European influence to what was the underground comic scene in America.
And you can hear from that the force of will and the independence of all of these women, and just and why identity and personal story and creation myths are so important to them.
Yeah,
because they had to stoke the fires of their personalities with these stories to propel them where they were lonely going.
Yes, absolutely. That's a really nice way of looking at it. I mean, I think that they all at some moment in their life decided to recreate themselves and therefore had to sort of exactly write creation myths, rewrite their own histories.
And some people go under the bus during those stories, you know, as it all, you know, fiery creation.
Yes.
And also, I do think in terms of, like, there's some ways in which you describe your mother, and I definitely recognize that the force of this will and pushing herself and those in front of her through the world, it's self-consuming in some ways. But also the force of keeping that alive, does it brooks no, like, especially with your grandmother, which I'll say, it brooks no, you know, confrontation. You
yes.
know, no naysaying.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, it really is something that I admire about them. It's just something that I needed to find a way to hold my own against. But they, yes, they have their own vision of how things were and how things are going to be. And they make themselves up as they go along, but they also make each other up as they go along into how they wish things had been. And in some ways, it was interesting trying to revisit these stories because there was a sense of what is the purpose of revisiting the difficult moments of our past? What is the purpose of trying to put a finger on these things that these women had wanted to forget or set aside? Is it necessary to unearth them, or is that simply a way of complicating the present?
Well, one thing that you unearth, and a gift you have given to both your grandmother and your mother, is the notion, which it was notional for them, that they are loved.
Yeah.
And you gave that to yourself as well.
That's a really nice way of putting it. I do love them both so deeply, and in some ways, being now able to see them as vulnerable as little girls, love them in a way that feels whole and personal. In a lot of ways, I think also I was able to see them as children, and they were able to see me suddenly as an adult who was ready to hear these stories, and it gave us this complete understanding of each other that you don't often get in a family.
Yes, because you've also helped bridge their gap.
Yeah, my mother, she said it's one of the things that she's most grateful for about the existence of this book is being able, through my story, to understand who her mother was as a child in a way that both she and my grandmother have said they wouldn't have been able to talk to about with each other.
I do want to ask about your grandmother's reaction to this book, because things in print have bothered her in the past, you know, which we have touched upon obliquely.
Well, she's a fiery and tempestuous woman. It's part of why I was drawn to her, and she absolutely continues to be. But without this book, I never would have gotten to know her. We never would have gotten close. And I think that both of us are grateful to have spent that time together.
And your aunts, because your mother does have two sisters, you know, and so everyone's story in the book. I just wanted to ask, because being as close to my mother as I was, and especially when she was dying, and I was doing some work with her, and I would speak with her every day, and I do know that that engendered, well, it was also my willingness to go there and talk to her and to ask, you know, to ask the tough questions like you did. But that did engender, and I think does engender, some feelings of being left out of that.
Mm.
And so has there been any, you know, even from your mother, has she been jealous of your relationship with José?
Oh, not at all. I think that my mother is really, I think that she loves her mother and she loves me and feels that pleasure that some people are able to feel when people they love each other. With my aunts, it's interesting because I did interview them at some moment when I was writing this book, and they had such completely different stories of their childhood than the one my mother was telling me that I decided to leave them out of the story intentionally. Not leave them out, but leave their versions of the story out quite intentionally, and their names are changed in the book. And there's, you know, I didn't want to write a tell-all. I wanted to write a very shaped telling about how we each have our own narratives, and I wanted to let those narratives resonate against each other through the generations. And there was a sense that if I got too many people's versions, then I was actually veering towards a real biography and a piece of objective journalism where there would eventually be a certain set of agreed upon facts. And what was more interesting to me was the sense of, when you only have these three people's stories, where do they contradict and how can you know?
Let's talk about the men in the book,
mm-hmm.
Or more importantly, not in the book,
mm-hmm.
as the case may be, because the only real male character in the book is your grandfather.
Yeah, and my grandfather does not come off well in the book, which is too bad because I never got to know my grandfather very well. I had a difficult relationship with him, and in learning these stories, came to believe that my mother had also had a complicated relationship with her father. In getting to know my grandmother, got to know such a more complex version of somebody who I had seen as simply an archetype. And I'm sure that if I'd gotten to speak to my grandfather in the same kind of way, he would have come through as a much more fully fledged character. The way that he exists in this book is simply as a projection and a reflection of a side character to these strong women's narratives.
But a very strong driver of both of them. You know, you know, José's intense shame at her parentage
mm-hmm.
is something he protects and then exploits.
Mm-hmm.
His ego is visited upon your mother in his desires,
mm-hmm.
you know, for what she does, etc. So they are very... He is a very propulsive character.
Yeah.
He's pivotal
in
various points and scenes in your mother's and your grandmother's life. But also, I it's always interesting to me when you're writing memoir, because it is a narrative arc, and as you say, there's a focus. And I think in the afterwards you mentioned your father, that, you know, he didn't mean to be, you know, as looming large in your life as he does, but there it is. You know?
Yeah.
But
I left my father out of the book quite intentionally, in part simply because he has such a powerful weight in the world already, and I really didn't want to write the, like, tell-all behind the scenes. When I started working on this book, my mother didn't have as much of a public-facing identity, and so part of it was just a celebration of her and wanting to pull her out of the shadows. And also for the same reasons that I said earlier of wanting to keep it as pared down to three generations of women's voices. My brother is also not at all in the book, but we're barely in the book.
Your mother at one point said, when you're sort of digging and digging through her and your grandmother's lies, which your grandmother would sometimes rebel against, you know, always asking these intrusive questions, you know, or interrogate her. You know, in these quite painful moments, especially for your mother, and that were visited upon her from her mother. And she's just saying, I just want a mother that I can love.
Yeah. And I think that's such a powerful thing to want. She tells me, you know, I made the conscious decision at some point to put my mother in my phone as Maman, even though she hadn't called her Maman for years. And she said, you know, I don't want to go digging through. I've never had a need to forgive my mother. She even tells me that she was never angry at her mother. She says that she was angry at her father, but that she was never angry at her mother, because being angry at someone means believing that they can change. And so I think that she moved an ocean away, she recreated her life, and then decided to form a new relationship with her mother that was just taking her fully at face value and fully in the present. And I admire that.
Yeah, it's hard to do.
Yeah.
But I also think that that's another way that we, you know, the fallibility of memory and our desire to have a loving memory or something is some of the ways in which we allow ourselves to rewrite the monstrous in our past.
Yeah. Well, the truth is, like, none of us are storybook creatures, but we all are creatures with stories. And so we get to sort of decide what those stories are going to be. I think that's one of the real sources of power. Even if we don't do it consciously, we're always rewriting our past, making each other up, making ourselves up, creating the world as we want it to be in order to allow for forward motion. Neither my mother nor my grandmother are people who are particularly resentful. They don't dwell, they don't hold grudges, they are focused on the future, and I'm really inspired by that.
Yes, and it's interesting to me, because one of the seminal stories for you, of your mother, about you, is that she would go into a burning building for you.
Yes. Yes.
That has been proven.
Yes.
And her story about Mina is a story that didn't even exist. That there was a doll that got lodged on a roof.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother didn't get it, but her grandmother would have.
Yes.
And those are lovely stories, but also those are one day, or not even a story. And that's what we pick out.
What's interesting is, I think our adolescence becomes as, like, hazy and unseeable as dreams do when we wake up. And all that we're left with are these tiny anecdotes that we then have to pin all of this narrative significance onto. So, for example, like, I remember my relationship with my mother being incredibly difficult when I was a teenager, but if I had to describe the specifics of what was difficult, I remember, like, one time that she yelled at me for opening milk that I hadn't opened. But that, for me, has to, like, hold all of the emotion that I felt during those years.
That was a big container.
Yes.
The big joke. Yes. Yeah, and those things that we use to sum it up.
Yes.
Nadia, thank you so much for your honesty and our truth as we know it.
Thank you so much for having me.
I took my love and took it down. Climbed a mountain and I turned around, and I saw my reflection in snow-covered hills, till the landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart rise above? Can I sail through the changing ocean tides? Can I handle the seasons of my life? Mm-hmm. protected my love. Take it down. Uh-huh. Climb a mountain and turn around. And if you see my reflection in the snow-covered hills, where the landslide brings you down. And if you see my reflection in the snow, the landslide will bring you down. Oh, the landslide will bring you down.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.